So I have, I can and have in the past talked for about 6 hours on this subject. Today we're just going to talk about the first of these, molecular biology for the bioinformaticist. And if we have time, then we can talk about gene measurement techniques, not just microarrays, but all sorts of different technologies, depending on how fast or how slow we go. So let's just get started then. So I have about 10 slides of basic biology, okay? If I see you start to yawn, okay, then we'll just go faster. There's a lot that we can cover, okay? So how many of you remember this kind of thing, okay? Do you remember this? Okay, so we can go pretty fast. So obviously the key problem in biology or in all of life science is that organisms need to produce proteins for a variety of different things that they need to do over their lifetime. So the goal is proteins. But the organisms have to make the same proteins again and again in a very set pattern type of way. Some of these proteins are important. They're enzymes to catalyze reactions. These reactions would otherwise take 10,000 years to complete. Because you have the enzyme in the middle, it can take 10,000 microseconds instead. Structural support, otherwise a bag of water would just collapse. These are the things that are going to hold the cell wall together to give it some shape. And certainly we have hormones to signal from one part of an organism to another part of the organism, or from one organism to another organism. So the key problem in life science over the past 50 years is how to encode the instructions for making these specific proteins, because they have so many disparate shapes, disparate lengths, characteristics. How does the organism know, or how do the cells know how to make these proteins? And the first step is obviously nucleotides. That's the basic, most basic element of these blueprints that goes into making the proteins. So we have adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, A, C, G, T. And as we all know, 50 years ago, we've learned that these were actually arranged in a chain, actually two anti-parallel chains, where the A's base pair with the T's and the C's go along with the G's. And these are not just arbitrary chains, but these are chains with polarity. So you have a start and an end to one chain. It's lined up with the start and the end to the other chain. And this is the double helix. This naturally forms a double helix if you melt this to the right temperature. If you heat the DNA, it starts to denature, but if you cool it again, it'll start to come back together again, or renature. So it's a natural formation depending on the temperature of the bonds here, the temperature needed to break these bonds. And so you get an idea of what this double helix looks like here. So now let's take a step back, okay? We have the DNA, we know that's going to be the end point. But we haven't had to even sequence the A's, G's, and T's, and C's to make genomic or genetic diagnoses, okay? So even for the past more than 50 years, we've been able to make genetic diagnoses even before sequencing was invented. How? Well, obviously you can actually look at the chromosome structure. So you can get a blood sample from any human, isolate the white blood cells, which still has DNA, and stain them in a particular way, take a photomicrograph of that, cut out the chromosomes and line them up. And so people have been doing this for decades, more than half a century. And basically, these chromosomes have been numbered based on the original estimates of the size of these chromosomes. So chromosome 1 is thought to be the biggest. Chromosome 22 is thought to be the smallest, but it turns out 21 is actually smaller than 22. And there's a couple other mispairings like this now that we have the exact length. But this is how we've been able to make genetic diagnoses. Each chromosome, okay, so each chromosome is a single double strand of DNA, okay, from end to end. And obviously it's wound and coiled and rewound and recoiled in such a degree that this looks nothing like a double helix, only because we're at a big picture here. We're at least five orders of magnitude up in terms of magnification from actually visualizing a double helix. Now, like I said, we've been able to make diagnoses for more than 50 years using genomics. Anyone want to guess what this diagnosis is? Let's keep this interactive here. This is Down syndrome, or trisomy 21. So you can see, obviously, it's highlighted here with the little arrow, but there's three copies of chromosome 21 here, and that happens to be a viable phenotype. You can be born with this, and you can actually live for quite some time, though you have marked phenotypic problems or phenotypic issues. You can live with that. This is trisomy 21. There's two other chromosomes that you can have an entire trisomy of and still survive one way or another. Now, we have 22 pairs of chromosomes here.
Interruption.
Yes.
Explain the following fact. So this is a proposal for final passwords. I'll keep on popping up everybody else. How come, with the exception of testicular cancer, Down syndrome people don't get cancer?
Okay.
Look at the genes, figure it out. I just heard Drew DePuppen present this. We don't get cancer.
So, like I was saying, we have 22 pairs of chromosomes that are ideally paired, although we can get trisomies rarely. We also have a pair of sex chromosomes. Either you have two X's or you have an X and a Y, and those are the normal conditions. There are abnormal conditions as well, but these are the sex chromosomes here. Most of the Y pairs with a piece of the X. But the Y has some unique material, and the X certainly has a lot of unique material that doesn't pair at all. There's some very important things on the Y. For example, a piece of the androgen receptor and things like that, the coding for that is on the Y chromosome. So this is what an actual photograph looks like, and this is the idealized version of this ideogram, with the bands essentially are actually quite specific with a particular stain. When a particular stain is applied, when you apply different stains, you get different banding patterns. And it turns out these bands actually have a lot to do with the base pair composition of those regions. For example, GC-rich, or regions that have a lot of Gs and Cs, will turn out to be one color versus the As and the Ts. So now we've seen the big picture from the chromosome. We started with the DNA and the nucleotides, and we've already covered the double helices. So just as an introduction, I got only 10 slides of basic biology refresher, and then we'll get to some interesting stuff. So how do we get from the DNA to the genes, right? Because even though we have 3.5 billion base pairs, only 1.5% of that codes for the proteins. We said the proteins were the final goal. And out of the 3.5 billion base pairs, only 1.5% actually are in a coding region, per se. So let's talk about what we call a coding region, exactly. This line here, this red line here, represents the double helix, okay? That represents the A's, C's, T's, and G's. And the structure of a gene is such that there's a piece here which is going to serve as our blueprint for the protein called an open reading frame. It's got a start, initiation. It's got an end, or termination. And there's pieces that are going to be spliced in and spliced out as part of this blueprint. And we'll talk about the splicing in a second. The piece of the double helix that's upstream, or before this, towards the 5' end, it's called upstream. And the piece of the double helix that's after this termination codon, it's called downstream, or it's on the 3' end. Now here's the most crucial point. We all love diagramming these things like this. But there is no punctuation in the genome. There's no highlighter. There's no caps lowercase. There's no italics bold. All you have are the letters, right? So one of the hardest problems is trying to figure out this structure from the letters, right? Because there's no flashing arrow that says here is where the gene begins. All you have are the A's, G's, T's, and C's, and it's only informatics that actually deciphers this, okay? So we have algorithms that people use commonly now that have been trained on manual experiments and the results of where this gene began and that gene began. They learn the patterns, they code it into algorithms, and the algorithms run on the entire genome to try to make predictions. But in the end, they're still only predictions of where these genes are, and they're still commonly wrong. So each gene, a gene encodes instructions to make a single protein, okay? The DNA is called upstream, and a lot of the regulatory elements for this gene are actually in the upstream component. So let's say more than they are in the downstream component. Regarding the splicing, if you imagine if an architect made a series of blueprints, but the architect said, well, if you don't want the jacuzzi in your house, you could take this page out, okay? If you only want a one-car garage instead of a two-car garage, you could take this page out. That's what this splicing is, okay? You start with a whole set of what could be in the plans, and pieces could be taken out, or pieces could be left in. That's what the exons and introns can serve as. The introns get spliced out, they can be thrown out, and exons remain to actually be part of the blueprint, which we'll talk about in the next few slides. Different tissues may splice in and out different components here. It's not always the case, even though I'm drawing it here as exon, intron, exon, in a different part of the same organism, that intron might be left in. Okay, that's still a mystery as to exactly why that happens in some tissues, not in other tissues. And even the mechanism, the proteins that are involved in cutting and splicing these things, are reasonably well defined. It's still not clear why is it sometimes specific to one tissue versus another. These are called alternative spliced products, okay? If I have the same open reading frame from start to end, that's how we define an open reading frame. If I have the exon, intron, exon in one blueprint, but just the two exons in the other, those are alternative spliced products. And because they're two different blueprints, you're going to get two different houses or two different proteins at the end. So we talked about the code at the start, the code at the end. And again, the biological system can figure out the promoter regions, where is the boundary between the intron and the exon, where is the start, where is the end, using just the sequence syntax. There's no highlighter, there's no bold bold or uppercase, lowercase. So we have three 3.5 billion base pairs, but only 35,000 genes. And the reason why, so this was an early estimate of 3%, it's actually only 1.5% of the genome, so only around 60 or 70 or 80 megabases or million bases out of 3.5 billion base pairs. So what makes up the rest? Okay, if I just showed you the structure of the gene, here is the gene that I just showed you, let's say. What makes up the space between genes? Well, we're not going to call it junk here, but the 50% of the regions between genes are repeated elements. Okay? So in other words, there are at least four different types of repeated elements, and those four are repeated many times in the genome. That makes up 50% of the genome itself. Now these repeated elements, so the repeated sequences are interesting, because early on, when people were using DNA in a forensic type of way, the number of repeats can be different between individuals. So what do I mean by that? So here is one type of repeated element. This is a line or long interspersed nuclear element. Doesn't matter what it is. But here you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6, 7, 8 copies of this line between this gene and this gene. So you might have 998 repeats between these two parts, but I might have 997 of them. And if you do that between a whole bunch of different areas of the genome, you can actually measure, you can actually find differences. You can do simple things like figuring out is a child a descendant of one or both parents. You can certainly tell to some certain degree of confidence whether a sample left at a crime scene is from this individual versus the random population. So just counting these repeats is actually pretty useful, even though today we have much more accurate ways of figure out whether a sample came from one person versus another. This is actually what was first used almost 20 years ago in the forensic view of the DNA. So these are the repeated elements here. And the number of repeats can be different between individuals. Now the repeat...
Another final project idea. Look at the number and placement of these repeats. And as you'll learn about in microarrays, you can measure comprehensive expression of the genome. There are thousands of arrays in the public. Can we actually determine what is it about the spacing or number of these repeats that does or does not influence human expression? Do they have a purpose, given that they're inserted quite widely throughout the species?
So the repeats themselves are also interesting for one other thing, okay? They're repeats, so it makes you think that these are copies of an original. And in fact, when we look at the sequence of these repeated elements, we can tell what the original looked like and how deviant is this sequence from the original. So how can we tell that? So what a repeat exactly is a repeat codes for machinery to make a copy of itself. That's all a repeat is. Okay, so let me be really clear. The repeated elements making up 50% of the genome codes for the machinery that goes back and makes a copy of itself. Okay, that's why it's going to persist in the genome, right? All you need is one or a couple of these things, that eventually they're going to come back and make copies of themselves as the genome goes on through evolution. Now, it turns out all of these repeated elements are broken today in humans. None of them work today in humans. That's not true in other organisms. Repeats are still alive and well in the mouse, but not in humans. In fact, they're all dead in humans. Why?
You mean they don't work in...
They can't work. None of them are working. They cannot go back and make copies anymore. None of them code for that anymore.
Okay. Generally evolutionary, what you see is the burst of new classes of repeats that populate a certain branch of the polygenic tree.
Absolutely. I have a whole thing on this if we get to it. Okay? If we get to it. So just think about that, okay? So these different types of nuclear, these different repeated sequences are all different ways to code for that machinery. That's all it is. Okay? We're the smartest organisms on this planet, or so we like to think, so we must have the largest genome, right? Absolutely wrong. So we have 3.5 million bases, or so it turns out with 3.5 million bases and only four letters, A, G, T, C, you can fit your entire genome on a CD-ROM. Okay? You don't even need a DVD for this. Okay? You can easily fit with no additional compression, you can fit your entire genome in 750 megabytes, okay, which is what a typical CD-ROM can hold. Okay? So just think about that for a second. So look at these other organisms and what their genome sizes are. The E. coli. So E. coli is a common bacteria that lives in your gut. It can be friendly, it can also be pathogenic. Has 4 million bases. Yeast, which is used to make bread, right? 12 million bases. But even the pea, the garden pea, right? You get peas in your salad maybe for lunch, has more of a genome than we do, 4.8 billion. Maize and wheat. Wheat has 17 billion base pairs, and we have 3 billion base pairs. Okay? So the size of the genome has nothing to do with the intelligence of the organism at all, it turns out. So where are these genomes different? A lot of the difference is in the space between the genes. So here are four organisms. Here's human, the same 50,000 base pairs I just showed you on the previous slide. And here are four genes within 50,000 base pairs and a whole bunch of repeats in the middle. Here's yeast. And you can see how many genes there are and very few spaces, so it's much more compact. Here's maize, and wheat would be the same thing. In 50,000 base pairs, there's only one gene there. And here's E. coli. In 50,000 bases, not only is it so compact, but there's actually genes on both sides of the genome, both strands, and they can even overlap, it turns out. Let me talk about that more specifically here. This is the genome for Plasmodium falciparum, which is the organism that causes malaria, okay? Still the number one infectious disease killer, okay, in the world. It's a chromosome 2, and you see the arrows here. The arrows represent which strand of the DNA the gene is on. They don't all have to be on the same strand, okay, making the problem even harder. And they can overlap, okay? There's many instances of a gene where another gene exactly overlaps. Makes it hard to measure one versus the other, it turns out. So this is the central dogma. We'll talk about central dogmas in a second, but this is basically the meat of how this happens, serves as a blueprint. As we all know, the DNA, somehow, when the cell decides to make this protein, somehow the DNA unravels in such a way to expose just the smallest piece of the 1.5% of the genome that's going to code for the protein it wants to make. And so the DNA is kept locked up and nice and safe in the nucleus, the center of the cells, and the proteins have to be made in the exterior of the cells. So a temporary copy is made of the DNA that goes out and it's going to be worked on to make the protein. And the temporary copy is called RNA, or specifically messenger RNA. And so when you unravel, a messenger RNA is actually made as in an opposite sequence, this is actually built in the opposite complementarity of the DNA. So if there's an A there, there's a T here, etc. That gets exported out actively out of the nucleus and goes into the cytoplasm where it's made into a protein. And to me, this is the most interesting part of the whole thing. Okay, somehow nature realized that you can't just make proteins with the four letters. Okay, you have A's, T's, C's, and G's, and proteins are made up of 21 amino acids. Okay, not 20, 21 amino acids. The 21st is actually one that was just discovered about 10 years or so ago, turns out. And the coding for that one breaks all the rules. And we could talk about that if people are interested. But there's 20 amino acids, let's say, and I have four letters. Obviously, if I made one amino acid for one letter, I couldn't do it. If I had two letters, I could have four things in this one and four things in this one. That would code for 16 amino acids, but I have 20 to choose from. So I need three letters to code for at least 20 amino acids. So that's what's known as the genetic code. I'm blanking on the term. So each position can be one of the four nucleotides, and nature evolved into using three nucleotides to code for a single amino acid. So that messenger RNA comes in here, and one of the most amazing pieces of nanotechnology, this ribosome, looks at the strand as it's coming in, and is able to link that strand with other amino acids that are held in place by these transfer RNAs that recognize these triplet sequences. So if there's a particular AAT, the tRNA that recognizes AAT, or rather the opposite of that, which is holding the right amino acid, comes into place, and the ribosome attaches it to build a growing protein chain. Okay? So in comes the RNA, out comes the protein. The micromachinery for this is astounding when you think about it. Remember, this is happening many, many times per second in all of your cells. You don't have to think about it, and hardly ever fails. If it failed, we just couldn't do anything. So here's this genetic code. So there's 64 different positions here, and So you see something like UUU, so U's are used in the RNA instead of T's. It's just a slight difference there. UUU's code for phenylalanine. UCC codes for serine, and that's the code, essentially. Now, obviously, these four different codes code for serine. It doesn't actually matter what the third base pair is. It's the first two are what are specific. So there's degeneracies in this code because we don't have to choose from 64. We only have 20 or 21 amino acids to choose from. So this is actually the central dogma here, and these are all the different concepts we've talked about so far. Talking about nucleotides, which are held in a double helix. One single double helix makes up a chromosome. The chromosome holds the genes, or DNA, and the entire set of all these genes is called the genome. The genes code for messenger RNA. The transfer RNAs bring the amino acids, and the ribosome operates on that to make the proteins. We'll talk about signal sequence in a second. The amino acids are joined together to make proteins, and this sequence of arrows here is called the central dogma. Even though the arrows work bidirectionally now, this is the original central dogma. Now, another fascinating part is this. Sometimes the cell needs to make something that would be quite detrimental to the cell. Okay? So, for example, there are cells in your pancreas that need to make things to digest the food we eat. Okay? I just went to the truck. I had a little dumpling. And I need to break down that protein. It turns out I can break down protein with something called trypsin. Okay, trypsin will help me break down proteins as well as many other things. But those things are proteins themselves. So here's the quandary here. How are my pancreatic cells, how are they going to make this trypsin without digesting itself? Right? How do I make proteins that are going to kill me if I need to make them? Well, so what happens is the first few base pairs of the sequence, in fact, the first few amino acids that get spit out by the ribosome might code for what's called a signal peptide. And the ribosome might see this and say, hold on, the thing I'm about to make could kill me. Okay, I need to stop here. And what happens is somehow the ribosome makes its way to a safer place to make the proteins, called the endoplasmic reticulum, or the ER. So this is the ribosome, here's the RNA coming in, here's the growing protein chain, and all of a sudden this red piece here gets recognized by an accessory part of the ribosome, the signal recognition peptide, and says, hold on, don't keep going here, because if I even have just one molecule of this, I'm going to start degrading the proteins within the cell. So the whole thing goes over, it starts to spit the protein chain into this hole, into the endoplasmic reticulum, where that can actually then be built safely. This is in a separate compartment that can be exported. It's a pretty sophisticated piece of nanotechnology, this thing. It knows, because it's given the right codes, to not digest itself, because it might need to make something quite toxic to the cell. There are signal recognition peptides like this likely for a lot of different compartments in the cell. Okay? Don't build this into the ER, build it somewhere else. The complete catalog of those is still unknown, but would be quite valuable to know. So how did the cell decide to make this gene? There's this area called this area of research is called transcriptional regulation. So why does the cell decide to make that messenger RNA? No one knows for sure in any one case how we actually get the DNA to unfold in just the right way for these things to actually be built. But we love to theorize, and we love to draw pictures like this. And you'll even see pictures like this in the New England Journal of Medicine now. Okay, this is a commonly accepted way to draw a gene. So here's the start of a gene. The arrow here means that this is where the gene is going to be, a copy is going to be taken off. And this is the upstream region. And these boxes represent things that can bind to that upstream region to turn on or turn off this whole process. So the GR here represents the glucocorticoid receptor. So when this cell sees steroids, the steroids are going to bind to the glucocorticoid receptor, and the glucocorticoid receptor is going to bind here. And this picture here shows that with the hormone, with steroids, this gets turned off. They put a little X here. And here, this is saying without, so with no steroids present, these two are actually bound in the natural state, but when you have that plus the glucocorticoid receptor, the thing gets turned on. So you can imagine things, in fact, other proteins, the glucocorticoid receptor is another protein, come back to the DNA and bind to the regions upstream of the genes to turn on and turn off other genes. So the whole thing is one amazing repetitive cascade. Genes code for proteins, some of which do their job, some of which come back to the DNA and turn on other genes or turn off other genes. And this cycle goes on endlessly. And we just know the smallest fraction of these cycles. Okay? Remember, we're drawing nice, pretty boxes like this here. There is no bold face, no highlighter, nothing upstream that tells us this is where it's going to bind. All we have are the letters. And a lot of slow motion biology goes into figuring out where these binding sites are. And we love to think that we have algorithms to do this. Some work and some don't. Huge area of research here, if we could figure out this immense network of transcription. What can start the process, even though these are going on endlessly? Whole different actions on cells can actually trigger specific responses. So for example, hormone action on receptors. I just had lunch. My pancreas is now making insulin. That insulin is a small protein. It's getting exported out of my pancreatic cells into my bloodstream. That insulin is going to now go to the muscle and fat because my stomach has taken in all this sugar from what I just ate, right? I need to store that sugar somewhere. So the insulin is going from the pancreas into the blood and triggering a response as I speak in my liver, fat, and muscle cells. So there might be a receptor up here, another protein. The insulin comes and binds and triggers a whole bunch of things to turn on and turn off different genes being expressed. Shock or stress to the cell. I just walked over here from Children's. It is freaking cold out there, okay? Whole bunch of things just started to be transcribed in my genome. New source of or lack of nutrients. If you have yeast and you put in one type of sugar, all of a sudden it starts to make things to deal with that type of sugar. If you change it to a different source of sugar, those genes go down, another set of genes go up. So that could start a whole bunch of genes being transcribed. Internal derangements of a cell. Okay, this is actually two different ways to make a transcriptional program. If I fly from here to San Francisco, I'm going to be hit with cosmic rays, and more than likely one of them is going to hit one of my cells. And all of a sudden, if it hits something in the wrong place, I might start to make a gene that I shouldn't be making. But even better, if my cell detects that it's making something it shouldn't be making, it might just decide to kill itself. Okay? Save me the problem of having cancer. So those are two different ways internal derangements can actually trigger these things. Sometimes cells can decide to kill themselves for the benefit of the organism, and that's another common way to start these programs. And of course, the list of things that can trigger a transcriptional program is endless. It's infinite, right? I can go like this, and I've just triggered some genes in my hand, for example. Anything could start these things going. Any questions so far? I have about 3 or 4 slides left on biology. Is this stuff you all already knew? Are you learning anything at all so far? Perhaps. Okay. So this is a little bit more esoteric now, okay? This idea of temporal programs. So one of the more important places where genes are getting turned on and turned off is during the development of an organism. Okay, so in our 10 months of gestation, when we're go from fertilized egg to actually leaving the womb, whole bunches of genes are getting turned on and turned off in a pretty well-defined program. And the picture I'm showing here is the difference between development and the terms they use here are segmentation versus homeosis. Okay, take a look at this picture, for example. These are two houses built in San Francisco in 1857. And they both started with the same blueprint, and they both started out, they're essentially the same house right next to each other. But after more than 100 years, the two houses look very different from each other. Okay? So this is given as an example in this cell paper as basically saying the genes that are involved in the development of a particular tissue might not be the same ones that refine the tissue after it's been built. Okay? So the same tissue can have two different programs on two different timescales in terms of gene expression. Now let's talk about this process of making the messenger RNA, because this is important. Our most impressive way to measure genes now happens to do a lot with messenger RNA. mRNA can be transcribed at several hundred nucleotides per minute. That's not that fast, actually. Okay? So if you have a gene that's 10,000 base pairs long, I'm only doing 100 a minute, maybe a couple hundred a minute. It could take me hours to transcribe one gene, okay? So thinking about this process, this actually puts it into a time scale that we can know and love here in terms of minutes. So the gene dystrophin, okay, dystrophin is involved in muscle. Turns out dystrophin has defects that can lead to muscular dystrophy. Dystrophin's involved in how muscles are formed and contract. One dystrophin gene can take 20 hours to transcribe. So how are we able to make enough of this if it takes 20 hours to make? Any ideas? If it takes 20 hours for me to make one transcript of dystrophin, and I need to make a bunch, how am I going to do that? You have to have a whole bunch of ribosomes, but what? You can have multiple copies of the gene in the genome, but there's one other way that you haven't thought of. Look, I'm telling you, it takes 20 hours at the start of the pipe to the end of the pipe, right? But I'm not telling you how fast I'm shoving things into the pipe. I can have one of the things making the MRIs right behind the next, so I could just stream off thousands of copies at a time, right? I don't have to wait for one to be done to start the next. I can have them all going, one base pair off of each other, a couple base pairs off from each other. That's how I can make more or fewer, but I still need all the ribosomes to make them into proteins. You're absolutely right. So that's an important concept. Even though they are long, it doesn't tell you really how many we can make given any unit time, okay? If the cell really wants to make a bunch of them, it could probably figure out a way to do it by just lining up the polymerases to make copies of the gene. Now, it turns out a lot of messenger RNA happens to end with poly A. Okay, so what do I mean by this? So as that little polymerase is working on the DNA, streaming off a copy of the mRNA, when it's done, it seems to stutter. Okay, so it adds a whole bunch of AAAAAAs at the end. Okay, lucky for us, okay, I'm sure there's some biological reason for this, but happens to be very fortunate for us, because if we have something, you know, that sticks to this wall that's just made of TTTTT, it's going to bind to the AAAAAs, and all of a sudden we can now have a big filter for all the messenger RNAs. Okay, all we have to do is stream the messenger RNAs past my little thing stuck to the wall with the poly T's, and it's going to bind to the poly A's. That's how we can fish out all the messenger RNAs from the general pool of RNAs that might be out there, because not all RNAs are actually coding for proteins. And in general, this is how we detect RNAs. You can take the sequence of RNAs and build the reverse complement of it. So everywhere there's a G, put a C in my detection. If there's an A, put a T. If there's a C, put a G. So we can use the reverse complement to help us tell whether this sequence is there or not, depending on how we design the probe. And we're going to talk about that. So this is, I think, the last slide. So why are we trying to do this whole genome project? Why was it important to actually complete the genome project? Eric Blinder basically uses this analogy that knowing all the genes is equivalent to knowing the periodic table of the elements for biology, right? So around 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, Mendeleev came up with the way of lining up all the elements in such a way to be able to predict characteristics of those elements. Now, back then, most of this was empty spaces because they hadn't seen some of these rare elements before. But they knew, by golly, there has to be an element right here that's inert, for example. Or there's got to be an element here that's magnetic. They could make these predictions even though they didn't see what was actually there yet. They hadn't discovered it. The same way, the periodic table for biology or for genomics isn't going to be a table, it might be a tree, because that's how these genes are actually formed, through duplication events. And so the idea is maybe we can predict that there must be something in the genome that's binding to this, or there must be something in the genome that's responsible for that. Now that we have the entire catalog, we can start to fish those things out. And what this whole course is how this is relevant to medicine. So most of the figures I've shown you here are from this book, Genomes. In fact, there's a second edition out. It might be one of the required reading or something for the course.
Yeah, sure. You don't know this.
But it's freely available at NCBI. Yeah, I definitely know this. So I would, and in fact, all the figures are there too. If you're interested in adding these things to reports and stuff, I highly recommend this more than anything else, only because it's very readable, lots of great figures to help explain these processes, and it's very cutting edge. Talks about proteomics, mass spec, microarrays, the whole works. Much better than other books, relevant books in this field. And the Department of Medicine has, at this website, has a primer on this. It's starting to get old now.
Did you guys receive the email with
this? This is starting to get a little old, but it's still quite relevant. That stuff will never get out of date. Okay, so I got another, let's say, 45 minutes or so?
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about gene measurement techniques. I will come up with something different for Tuesday. So what I'm going to talk about now, so any questions so far? Yes?
I just have one question about the time scale for the transcription.
Sure.
Does anybody know, so you can write out multiple transcription components to pump out these slower things, right?
Yep.
And I guess assuming that the transcription complex binds to the start.
Exactly.
Faster than it moves along the string. What's like the lower limit, or I guess the upper limit? What's the fastest these things can?
So what's the fastest that gene can be transcribed?
Yeah, so because you've got the first transcription complex has to move out of the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you just have immediate binding of the next one.
You could probably do the math, okay, and figure this out,
exactly.
Okay?
I mean, that's a great final project, actually.
Right. So,
seriously.
You can model this, right?
A sound basis, understand everything we know about the initiation of the transcriptional site and moving on and the letting go, all the things that have to happen, and there are quite detailed documentations of the teaching processes. What is upper bound for transcription and translation?
But basically, you can model the whole thing as a pipe or a channel, okay? And the length, I already told you the length of this thing, right? How long it takes to make dystrophin. You just have to model how fast I can put the next one in. You might be able to model based on just looking at the size of the polymerase and maybe how many base pairs it's covering up. Maybe it's got to move out of the way before the next one can come in. You can model it just like that, for example. It would be quite interesting to see how that matches up with the actual published numbers for it. My bet is that's probably still not the rate-limiting step in this process. That's another interesting question. What's the slow part here? I'm not actually sure. It probably depends on the genes, actually. There's some important proteins that are only 10 amino acids long. Okay? Insulin, for example, is on order of like 50 amino acids. Okay? So some of those can be spit out pretty quick. And then you got some that are huge, like dystrophin and chitin, some of these others. Any other questions? So far? So again, remember, there's no nice line there. It's got to be in the sequence. So there are specific sequences that are known to be intron-exon boundaries. But clearly they're not 100%, because in other cells, that same sequence might result in another transcript. So there are intron-exon boundaries at both the start of the intron and the end of the intron. And turns out one end of it complements the other side, so these things are actually taken out in a loop type of form. Okay? So the thing that cuts this thing out lines up the mRNA in such a way that's able to put the start and end together and just basically snips the whole thing out like that. I can refer you to pictures in the genomes book exactly on this. But again, it's not 100%.
So we got things like GA, for instance, is one of the dinucleotides that sometimes initiates the splicing complex. But often it doesn't. GA is a very common dinucleotide. So this that goes up to it. The syntax that determines the splicing is not known. So we have some heuristics which work some of the time. We have not reverse engineered the transcriptional the alternative splicing code.
You think about this, this is a massive decryption effort in the end, right? All we have are the A's, T's, C's, and G's. One level of coding is the triplet codon for the amino acids. But another more interesting one is the grammar here, okay? Where's the start of the gene? Where's the end of the gene? What do I splice in? What do I splice out? Where are all the transcriptional regulatory elements? That's the holy grail here, okay? That is the holy grail.
Is coding?
We know those, okay?
But those don't always work either.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'll tell you exactly why, okay? The code for the start is only there's only one code for start, AUG, but there's three codes to stop, okay? It turns out one of the codes to stop, if there's another code 100 base pairs later, that makes the 21st amino acid, okay? So in other words, you can't even just look at the triplets. It's in the context of other things, too. Makes things messy again, right? They're so nice and neat with just triplet codons. But that stop plus something else 100 base pairs later gives the 21st amino acid, selenocysteine. That's life. Messy. People for the life of them couldn't figure out why, how are you making selenocysteine proteins? There's only four in humans, okay? One of which is involved in the thyroid, okay? Which is why a whole bunch of endocrinologists look at this. It metabolizes thyroid hormone into one form to another. Thyroxine to triiodothyronine. That enzyme has a selenocysteine, and people couldn't figure out why it was coding for selenocysteine because it looked like a stop codon there, right? Well, you can start to figure these things out once you have the whole genome now, okay? You can look for these exceptions. Okay, let's be very specific, okay? The repeats code for a protein that comes back, looks for the sequence, and actually integrates the sequence somewhere else in the genome. Okay? Repeats code for a protein, like any other gene, that finds its sequence and puts it in somewhere else in the genome. But for that to happen, the code for the protein has to work, right? If it's damaged beyond repair, the thing can't work. And sometimes it makes mistakes. So the thing's coming back, right? I made a protein, it's coming back, and it's trying to make a copy of itself. Sometimes it grabs the wrong thing to make a copy of. So that's why we have copies of lots of things in the genome. Good question, okay? It's able to recognize its own sequence, but it's not at all perfect. Okay? But what we can say about the difference between human and mouse is that the mouse has those sequences for that protein, a reverse transcriptase, it has codes for it that seem to be fully functional. And in the human, there are none that are still functional. That's what we're saying. It's very curious why that is, okay? This whole area of genomic archaeology that you can do with the genome now, okay? In fact, what Zach was saying earlier is that we have so many millions of repeats, right? That we can look to see how deviant they are from a working copy, right? And so we can age each of the repeats. This one's 40 million years old, this one's 50 million years old, because if it's got four places where it's different, and this one only has two, the one with four is probably older than the one with two, right? So like that, we can age all of these repeats. And turns out a whole bunch of them were made at a certain point in time, and then they've dropped off. Again, no one knows why. I'll show you the graph in a second here.
So you can assume that the genome is growing over time. So then maybe in some thousand years, the genome is much bigger than now.
Or smaller, too. There's ways to get rid of these things, too. Right? If you do too much damage, the thing can't reproduce. And that's it. It's the end of the line. The most mind-blowing thing that the Genome Project has done for me, personally, is that now I realize there's only one life form on this planet. Okay? It's DNA. Everything else is a side effect, okay? That DNA is doing everything it can to actually keep its code going. That's all there is. There's a great book called
The Self-Machine.
The Self-Machine, of course, but there's also a more recent one called, it's not Genomes, it's a paperback, the Autobiography of a Genome, I think it's called. It's like 23 chapters, and basically they pick one gene from each chapter to make a story. It's a great book. I recommend reading that. It's lay kind of reading.
Yeah,
it's on a bestseller list for a while. Autobiography of a Genome, I think it's called. Something like that. Some chapters were harder to write than others, I think, for this guy.
The hardest chapter, go ahead.
Okay, it's just a question about the age, you know, like aging mutations and whatever. Given that you can pretty much get rid of or add to, or it seems like dating genes according to the mutation, number of mutations against a mutation frequency, whatever, it seems kind of invalid now.
Are you saying that because of these kinds of influences, just looking at the differential rate of synonymous substitutions versus a non-synonymous substitution is not a good clock anymore?
I guess. I guess I'm getting what I'm driving is there. It seems like one of the underlying points that you've been making is that there's a lot of change and a lot of mistakes that can be introduced from a variety of sources, none of which have to be all that magnificent or catastrophic, you know, just everyday sorts of things. And yet, on the other hand, when we're talking about, you know, well, this gene is probably older because it has four mutations
right.
too.
Right. It's all based on, that's a great point. We can age these things because we think we know models, okay? So given a fixed rate of nucleotide substitution, okay, where people have tried to calculate numbers for that, we can make a premise. But if that's not true, then it's not going to hold.
So okay? For instance, if you have a transposon that's boxed right in the middle of the gene, then that would be invalid if you look at the rate of mutation across the same stretch, but got a new puzzle just blocked right in the middle of the thing you're trying to compare. Your model's wrong. But if you have a stretch, I mean,
right.
a stretch that's more or less the same, except for some mutations, then a lot of these not catastrophic, but more violent changes.
Right.
And
it's all a matter of time scales, okay? These things are making copies of themselves over millions of years, okay? It's not a day-to-day kind of thing at all. That the cell in my lung can make a copy of itself and move it somewhere in the genome. On the grand scheme of things, who cares? It's not in my sperm cells. It's not going to go on, right? So it's got to happen in the right cell at the right time. Across millions of years, these things are happening when you think about it, right? It's got to be in the right cell, too.
When you're looking at the regions between genes, is there anything to say that the rates of mutations would be about the same in all regions or some regions?
Well, actually, one of our assistants studied. Well, that's what we're
talking. Yeah, I think the rates are definitely different between different regions, okay? Only because some of these processes have different rates. Like, remember the banding pattern I showed you, and the AT rich, that corresponds to regions that are rich in AT and rich in GC. Some processes occur at different rates between them, because there are tighter bonds there, okay? It might, but we don't have any way to model
that.
We don't have any way to model it.
We know, which was, you know, when the human genome was first presented in 2000, this graph, people refer to what between the genes of junk DNA. When you look at the percent of sequences from CERT of DNA through the phylogenetic tree, the percentages are quite similar for the intergenic region, that's what the genetic region tells us. Evolutionarily speaking, this stuff is important, and whether it is to keep selfishly some DNA elements to survive, or the infection necessary for organisms function,
let me just show this one slide, because you're asking so many questions about repeats, and this sort of summarizes a lot, okay? So 3 million repeat copies started as working elements. That's how they can model this, okay? There's 3 million repeats in the genome. Measure how far are they away from a working copy of them, okay? Because through time, these mutations just happen randomly, presumably at a fixed rate, but not necessarily slow. Most of the repeats predate the mammalian radiation, so before mammals were even formed. Most of these repeats are actually older than that in the genomes. But there's no evidence for transposon activity in the last 50 million years since we've diverged from monkeys. None of these things have been alive. But they're still well, alive and well in the mouse and the rat, okay? So not all, go ahead.
Is that it? I mean, what's sort of the breakdown? How many species is it still? I mean, are monkeys still doing this, or is it gone
down? I don't think we know yet, because the monkey genomes are just being finished now, right? So we can better answer this question every month, right? By the end of this course, you'll be able to answer better than today, because these genomes are coming online. Literally, this is just only 2 years old information.
But it does pay for that.
What's that?
It's a fairly procrastinate.
You're never going to be done sequencing every organism on the planet, but I think we'll have a better estimate now than when this paper came out, if you choose to do this. Here's the graph that I like to think of, okay? So the different bars here, the different colors represent the different repeat elements, okay? The lines, the signs, they're just different codes, okay? And here are less than 1% substitution from a working copy. And here's 34% substitution from working copy. And you can read that as millions of years, basically, going back hundreds of millions of years. And you can see at 7% substitution, there's a peak, and then it drops, and then a slight peak, and then it drops. So these aren't fixed at all. Makes you wonder what happened on the planet at this point in evolution. Why were all of these things alive, for example, and then all of a sudden they've died off down to zero? So it's amazing when you think about that. Only because they model these as working copies, and how do they diverge from those working copies? It's fascinating. Genomic archaeology. This was not a field 3 years ago, right? The relevance of medicine still has to be determined, though, so which is why we're going to move on. Okay, so I got about 20 minutes left. Let's see how much of gene measurement techniques I can cover here.
So hard to find yourself.
Going till 2, right? Okay. Say 30 minutes. So the gene measurement techniques I'm going to talk about today are how do we measure DNA, how do we measure RNA, and how do we measure proteins? Okay? If you can get this, you're going to know 95% of what you need to know in this area. Let's start with DNA. So DNA sequencing was invented back in the mid-70s. And when we measure DNA, we're sequencing it. Okay, so we want to know the sequence of A, G's, T's, and C's. And so how did we get all 3.5 billion base pairs? Basically, just slightly more automated ways than what I'm going to show you here. So what you can do is, if you have a DNA sample, remember it's A's, G's, T's, and C's, we have tools to make copies of them. Okay, in fact, we can borrow the enzymes that the cell uses, and in a test tube, I can take my A's, G's, T's, and C's and make copies of them. Okay, the process of making copies is a technique called polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. All PCR does is make copies of things and amplify them. If you have one, you make it into two, then those two become four, four become eight, etc., and it grows to be pretty big, something that you can actually visualize. So now, basically the way this technique works is this. As I'm making a copy, okay, of one strand of DNA, let's stop the reaction. Okay, so as I'm making a copy, let's say of 100 base pairs, let's stop the reaction. And I stopped it after I have a whole bunch of copies going. So some of the copies are going to be 50 when I stopped it. Some are going to be 99, some are going to be 98, some are going to be 97. So I'm going to have a whole variety of lengths of copies of that gene, of that sequence. It might not even be a gene. So then let's start it up again. But the last base pair I'm going to add to that copy, I'm going to make fluorescent. Okay, and I'm going to make it fluorescent in such a way that I'm going to make four colors. One color for A, one for T, one for C, one for G. Okay, so I can make four different fluorescent colors that I can incorporate into the nucleotide, the last nucleotide I'm going to put on this particular sequence. Okay, so now I have a whole variety of lengths, and the last base pair might be a fluorescent color. Then what I can do is I can put that whole mix of length of DNAs and put them in a gel. And when I actually activate an electric current, the DNA starts to fall because DNA gets pulled based on its charge. But as you would guess, the smaller sequences get pulled faster because it's easier to move than the larger ones. Even by one base pair, you can separate them this way. Okay, it's called gel electrophoresis. That's why a one base pair difference we can see on a gel, depending on the charge and all of this kind of thing. So then what you do is you put a laser down at the bottom of the gel. So it used to be we'd run the gel out, and if it went off past the end, you'd swear because you just ruined your sequence. You lost it. It's in the puddle at the bottom of the gel. But now we want it to happen this way because we set up a laser at the end that excites whatever fluorescent is coming down there. And depending on the color, we can just read it off. Okay, oh, here's a red peak. Here's a blue peak. Here's a green peak. Okay. And then software, so we have a whole bunch of these peaks, and then software looks at this. In fact, the most commonly used software for this is something called Frap and Fred, which is an open source, freely available program. People don't even use the software that came with the thing. They wrote their own, it's open source, and looks at the peaks, and then makes the call. I see this peak here, I think it's a G. I see this peak here, I think it's a C. Okay? There's going to be immediate problems with this. Okay? First, despite how fancy this looks, we still can't do more than 300 base pairs with this.
The time of the peak appears somewhat related to the size of the...
They all, in theory, should be just one base pair apart, okay? But there's all sorts of reasons. So why are there some jumbled here and some that are spaced out here? As you let the thing go, okay, it's not a linear thing, the spacing, okay? So as you let it go, it gets wider and wider and wider in general. But sometimes the copying process itself can have errors. Okay, let me be clear. If the sequence I'm starting with has a whole bunch of G's in a row, sometimes it gets confused, and it just happens to make the wrong length, right? So if I have a lot of repeats in the sequence I'm trying to sequence, I'm going to have problems. And I just told you 50% of the genome is repeats, okay? It's not easy.
But also, different sequences might have different efficiencies in these reactions.
Yeah.
And so that might cause...
But basically, we can't do more than 300 to 400 base pairs than this, beyond this. And this is state of the art. This is the state of the art. So to go from this to 3.5 billion base pairs, you do it 300 at a time. Okay, that's it. There's no more magic than this. There's also another problem. What if I have two peaks in the same spot? Remember, I have two chromosomes. On one chromosome, it might be one letter. On the other, might be another letter. Happens all the time. One in 1,000, turns out, which we'll talk about. That's a polymorphism. It could be this or that. So that's how you can read it, by looking at the peaks as well. That's basically it. You terminate the chain with a fluorescent nucleotide. And you just line them up, and you just read them off at the bottom. And Fred basically makes the calls here. It looks, the software looks at the peaks and makes its best guess here. So all of these peaks, not just the letters. I told you the letters would fit on a CD-ROM, right? If you wanted to keep the tracings, you're going to need a hell of a lot of storage, okay? On the order of hundreds of terabytes for just one human. But they're all stored, and they're all saved for the Human Genome Project. Because people go back and say, well, this peak wasn't so high. I don't think this was the right letter. But for the Human Genome Project, not only do we have all 3.5 billion base pairs, we also have an assessment of how good of a call it was for each letter based on these peaks. Okay? So how do we get to the entire Human Genome Project? You automate the process. So this is a picture of the Genome Center of the Whitehead Institute. And basically, it's a whole bunch of robots just going off, setting these things going. Okay? Most of the genome was sequenced in just the 12 months prior to the finish of the genome, right? Even though the process had been going on for 10 years, it takes time to develop these machines, develop the technology, and more importantly, to develop the strategy, which we'll talk about in a second. And then the machines were built and basically could do the whole genome in 12 months at the end. You can see the number of genes that were in draft form grew exponentially until the end, even though it started back in the mid-90s. The Whitehead can run 100,000 sequencing reactions every 12 hours, okay? Multiply that by 300 base pairs for each, and you can get on the order of 3 million base pairs, let's say, if I do 300, it's going to be 30 million base pairs, let's say, every 12 hours now. The robots pick all the colonies, because these things have grown up in bacteria. Okay, here we go, 60 million nucleotides per day is the current estimate, what they can sequence. We couldn't do it even 5 years ago. So then you have all of these little pieces of 300 base pairs, okay? And somehow you need to put this entire jigsaw puzzle back together, right? So there's essentially two ways you can do this. You can start with some strategy and say, well, I'm just going to take this piece of this chromosome and sequence that. Then let's move to the next piece and sequence that. And take that and take that and just have some structure in mind as to the order you're going to do it and keep track of the pieces. And then you know how they're going to go back. The opposite approach is called shotgun sequencing. And that's basically saying, take the entire genome, split it up into these 300 base pair fragments, and split it up again. Take the whole genome and split it up again into 300 base pair fragments using some other way. Okay. So the place where I'm going to cut it for this method are going to be different than the ways I cut it for this method. Sequence the whole mess and just see what overlaps. Like basically, this piece of this puzzle seems to go in this piece of that kind of puzzle. And you basically put the whole pieces together like that. Now that assumes a lot of computational power. Okay. Now keep all these things in memory. You got to line them up and see which ones work best. So the best approach in the end was a hybrid. Okay, you don't just put all the pieces together, but you also keep some idea of the scaffolding, where you got the pieces from, instead of just doing it randomly like this. So a hybrid, like most things in life, a hybrid worked the best. But here are the pieces, here are all the pieces cut one way, here are all the pieces cut another way, and this is basically saying, well, A1 and A2 has no overlap, so we're stuck there, we don't know how they join, but A2 and A3 might have some overlap, and there's B here, and then basically put them together based on the pieces, and hopefully you have some overlaps between them. This A goes with this A, but we also see B and B here. So here's B1 fits right here, and B3 fits like there, et cetera, et cetera. That's how these things are joined. Obviously, you're going to need a whole bunch, right? You're going to need a whole bunch, and there's a lot of holes. And again, I told you 50% of the genome is repeats. So, but statistically speaking, you're going to get a whole bunch that look like they fit together, right? That's why this doesn't work that easily right out of the box, okay? Because you have too many small pieces that look so much like each other. So that's why hybrid approach works best. If you remember that this piece came from chromosome 1 and this band and this thing, then actually you then could put it somewhere physically in the genome. So for the human, they had 10 four-processor machines with 4 gigabytes of RAM each, and a 16 processor with 64 gigabytes, and that took 10,000 CPU hours, okay? So that's a huge amount of computational power just to put all the pieces together for the human. The overlap stick memory, 600 gigabytes of RAM. And in the end, the hybrid of putting it on a physical map is the way to go. Let's see if I have that there. So now we're at a state where you can actually go to websites like this one at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which is probably one of the more popular ones, and you can just start to browse the genome. So if you just pick, you can even hit a button to take you to a random spot in the genome. Here's an arbitrary region of chromosome 19. It shows you where the bands are, where the GC-rich regions are, or what you would see on a karyotype, where the predicted genes are, where actually people have seen different pieces of the gene in messenger RNA, so you can start to tell where the introns and exons are, where the polymorphisms are, all on one screen, and there's actually two different commonly used browsers for this. I think the next screen, this is just a blow-up of the UCSC browser. This is like a running thing of the GC content here. So that gets us to this, okay? So now, I already started to hint at this. Let's say, off the automated sequencer, you see peaks like this, okay? Where here, I see a little bit of a hump here and a little bit of a hump here, or here, exactly. Two humps that are exactly the same size. That makes you think, that, I mean, the program puts a little N here because I don't know which it is, an A or a T. But what that really could mean is that that could be a polymorphism, that that human actually has both letters, one on one chromosome, one on the other chromosome. And so if you have a chunk of DNA that you're interested in finding polymorphisms, you can get that gene or get that chunk of DNA, sequence in 100 humans, and just see what the different letters are in that sequence. That's one way to do it. But they found a whole bunch of these polymorphisms just by doing the Genome Project, okay? The Genome Project was sequencing 30 or so humans, and there are going to be differences in 30 people. So a whole bunch of them were found that way as well. So you can either do this while sequencing the genome, you find arbitrary polymorphisms, or if I'm interested in this gene because I think it's involved in asthma, I want to see if there's polymorphisms, I can go after that gene and sequence it the same way. Both ways are going to look like this on the automated sequencer, two peaks there. You could also use microarrays, which we'll skip this one, but you can use an array to help you find these SNPs as well. So I think you're going to have a lecture on SNPs, right? There's someone...
Joel Hirschhorn, who is an expert from the Whitehead, was telling you about SNPs and problems in interpreting SNP-based.
So I think this is my last slide on DNA measurements, okay? And I'm just going to end on clinical use of SNPs because this is genomic medicine, okay? So again, SNPs are single nucleotide polymorphisms. At a particular arbitrary spot in that genome, you have an A, I have a T, let's say. Okay? And it's usually just one thing or another. There's places where there's three combinations. Usually it's one or the other. That happens on average, rough estimate, but 1 in 1,000 base pairs can be a polymorphism. So if you do the math, that's maybe 3 million, 10 million different spots in the genome where you could have one letter or another. And figuring out the association of those letters to differences in susceptibility to disease is another holy grail now, okay? If you have diabetes, I don't have diabetes, you have these letters, I have these letters, maybe those letters have something to do with it, is the basic idea. Now here's one particular figure from an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, just to give you an idea. This one particular gene called HLA, and this is specifically HLA-B, and you can have, it's a particular HLA gene, and you can have one particular polymorphism on both your chromosomes. You can have a mix of one or the other, or you could have the most common form of this. So there's a common form of the letter, this is a rare form, or you can have a mix of the two. And this one particular gene, if you're infected with HIV, that one spelling determines your conversion to AIDS. It can actually have a huge impact. So if you have this rare form of the polymorphism, and on both your chromosome, homozygous, you can go from having HIV to AIDS very quickly, within 10 years. If you don't have, if off both your chromosomes have the more common form, you can go on and on. And some people never get AIDS, okay, as far as out as 18 years. And if you have the mix, you're somewhere in between here. So associations of SNPs with diseases are exceedingly common to find now. In fact, every other week in the New England Journal of Medicine, this is what you're reading. It's going to be some association with this spelling versus that disease.
What's the most frequent form in this case?
The most frequent is going to be no HLA, the black one. Yep. So let me ask you, okay, how much do you think it costs to measure a SNP? Okay, so if I have one arbitrary spot in all of our genomes that I want to measure, whether there's an A, T, C, or G in any arbitrary genome, how much do you think it costs? Not how much the lab charges, how much do you think it costs to measure one base pair? How much does it cost? Guesses. You already asked? Yeah, so I came up with the answer, 5 to 10 cents, probably going to be 1 cent in the next few years. Pretty cheap. Stole my thunder. All right. How do you get to, oh, yeah. One more. Last thing on SNPs, okay? You didn't take this, did you?
I did too.
Yeah. Stop giving you my slides. Okay. How much time do I have? Okay. Let's talk about gene expression. Okay, let's talk about microarrays for a slide, and then we'll talk about protein. So we already covered DNA. Now we're working our way out of the nucleus, okay? Now let's talk about the messenger RNA. So like we said, if the cell decides to make a particular protein, it's going to start making the blueprints for that protein, the messenger RNA. Turns out it's very easy to measure these now. The most common way to measure them is using a microarray. All a microarray is a 2 centimeter by 2 centimeter, about the size of your thumbnail. It's a man-made grid of DNA where each spot in the grid is looking for one particular RNA. And so the density is about 500 by 500, so that's on order of like a quarter million different spots on these arrays. And suffice it to say, you can measure the entire genome of transcripts with one array today. And the way this works is you have to get the tissue that you're interested in. You can't just do this from blood, unless you're interested in blood. If you're interested in the brain, you got to get the brain tissue to figure out what genes are turned on there. Might expose it to certain influence, get the RNA, so isolate it, remember? Most of them are sticky with the little A, we just have to get the T's and pull them out. Make them fluorescent by making copies of them. Remember I showed you that technique, you can make a copy of something using the PCR and just have it put fluorescent ones in there and it'll become fluorescent. Let it sit on this man-made grid overnight, come in the morning, wash it off, light up with the laser. The laser lights up the fluorescence and you basically take a picture. And you get a TIFF image, okay? If you scan in pictures at home, you know what a TIFF image is. But these are huge. These are on the order of 10 megabytes, these files. And then the biology takes a pause, the informatics comes in and starts to quantitate each of these. It's quantitative to 4 to 5 orders of magnitude. And though it's not perfect, there's a lot of noise, most people like this technique. Again, these are also commodity items today. You can get one of these for the entire genome for about $300-$350 today on Longwood. The quantitative, there's at least two different ways to do this. There's an absolute measurement technique and a relative technique. So what does that mean? How much of this gene is present is one technique. How much is this gene is present relative to this other tissue is another technique. And the relative one uses two fluorescent colors. The absolute one uses one fluorescent color. Depends on what the nature of the spots are, but we're not going to go into those details unless you really want to. The important point is that the genes are chosen arbitrarily. Okay? Statisticians hate this aspect of it. These are not drawn from some master normal distribution here, okay? This year's chips are different than last year's chips because we know more of the genes. Next year's chips are going to be different than this year's chips. So every year these things are changing. There's not ever going to be one fixed genome here. And you need the functional tissue, okay? There's some diseases that are easy to study with microarrays, like cancer. If you have a solid tumor, patient goes to the operating room, the tumor gets taken out, you have a hunk of tissue, you can extract the RNA, you can find a lot of genes this way. And so that's why most of the microarray papers involve cancer. Slightly harder disease to study might be something like diabetes. Okay? Diabetes affects the liver, muscle, fat, pancreas, maybe brain simultaneously. You might want to get all of those tissues. And let me tell you, we don't normally do biopsies of these things when we diagnose diabetes, but we could use animal models, etc. Slightly harder disease to study would be something like schizophrenia. I know the functional tissue. But just which part of the brain am I going to actually get and put on this array? I can't take an entire human brain and do this. Is it this part or this part? So I even know the tissue, but I don't know where I'm going to put the array. What am I going to put on the array? And then one harder disease to study would be something like hypertension. What's the functional tissue in high blood pressure? Is it the heart? Is it the blood vessel? Is it the smooth muscle of the blood vessel? What exactly am I going to put on the array to learn what genes are up and down? So this is not the panacea for all diseases, okay? If you want to know what genes are functionally involved, you have to be able to think about the functional tissue here. Yes?
How long after death can you do this?
The easy way to answer that is that people have been able to get RNA from paraffin-embedded tissues. Okay? So, and they think that they're successful. But most people flash freeze these things. If you're in the OR with the tumor getting taken out, most people just put it into minus 70 right then and there.
The slightly longer answer is RNA does degrade. So as opposed to the DNA, which can stick around, and that's why we can, you know, do Jurassic Park-like stunts.
But RNA is, there's a reason why RNA degrades, because we degrade it, okay? A lot of viruses are just strands of RNA, so it's not in our interest to degrade it. So we have RNases, we exude RNases. It's much harder to work, I mean, high school students work with DNA, right? If you've ever done this in your high school where they go get blood from, you know, an abattoir and they just basically get the blood and you can look at the strands of DNA, you can't do that with RNA because we all have RNases, we're going to degrade it immediately. So you had to wear gloves, you had to use special techniques, etc.
I've done studies, for instance, just looking at hours after death, and definitely a muscle tissue 4 hours after death has a different transcriptional factor pattern than when I was after apoptosis, for instance, kicked in, and many other things that kicked in. And so if you really want to do it reasonably, then basically as close as you get the moment of death is where you want to be.
This is what these arrays actually look like. This is the whole human genome array from a company called Affymetrix that makes these things, and they actually make a 96 well format of this. So here are 96 microarrays in just one plate. So you can imagine how much data you get out of this with 10 megabytes of each for each of these images. Huge amount of data being collected this way. And we're not going to talk about the differences here. And we'll not talk about that. So you can use these microarrays to tell which genes are up. So for example, if I have a whole bunch of patients and half of them had one type of leukemia and half had another type of leukemia. Leukemia means a whole bunch of white blood cells go up in the blood, so you get easy access to that tissue. And you can find genes that are up in one and down in the other, or down in one and up in the other, et cetera, et cetera. In the end, you can get lists of genes very easily now. We all commonly do this, okay? And this core facility is basically in every hospital. If you're a clinician at the Brigham Women's Hospital, you can take your sample down to the core facility and they'll give you back the text file. This gene, this amount, this gene, this amount. It's just a matter of asking the right questions now. But the list of genes isn't enough, okay? Sometimes you want to go back and validate that a gene is actually where it's supposed to be, or what you thought was actually happening. And there's two ways to do this, in situ hybridization and real-time PCR. So these are usually inserted after you've done a microarray analysis. In situ hybridization is very easy. I take the same RNA that I'm looking for, make the exact reverse complement of it, and make it fluorescent again. And I make enough of it that I can then stain a sample, a tissue sample, with that and then light it up to make a picture. So wherever that transcript was, this is going to stick to it after I've washed it off, and it's going to light up. And I can take, you know, glorious pictures like this. I can use different colors to light up one RNA versus another. And that might help me tell that it's in the right tissue that I thought it was. Real-time PCR is even easier. It's actually a little bit harder to conceptualize, but basically real-time PCR uses that polymerase chain reaction technique to actually detect one sequence as compared to a control sequence. Okay, so it gives me a more quantitative measurement. This gives me a nice picture that I can put on the cover of Nature. The RT-PCR actually gives me a number that actually can then be used to validate the microarray findings. It was 3 times higher, it was 4 times higher. It's basically using a PCR technique to see how fast do I get a detectable amount, using the repetitive, the exponential growth aspects of PCR. So now let's get into proteins, okay, because we're coming close to the end of the hour here. So again, the holy grail is get to proteins. We all essentially use microarrays as a proxy for proteins. But we don't have an array, the same kind of array that we have for microarrays, we just don't have it for proteins. Why? Because proteins are much harder to measure, okay? The RNA basically is A's, T's, C's, G's, and it's essentially a strand, and sometimes it buckles and has twists, but it's pretty easy to measure using these microarrays. Proteins can be positively charged, negatively charged. They can love water, they can hate water. They can be big, they can be small. If you look at it this way, it looks like one thing. If you look at it this way, it looks like another thing. So there's no easy, consistent way to measure proteins like there is for RNA. Just to give you an idea, here is a commonly used technique called 2D polyacrylamide gel for electrophoresis, or 2D PAGE. Take one sample, a gamish of proteins. I've made all the proteins radioactive, and I'm going to spread them out this way based on the size. Remember, if I put a charge, I can the smaller things move down faster. So here's size, and here's pH. Here's the pH that they like to hang out in. Two different things, two different aspects of proteins. And in the one gamesh, I have all of these spots. Okay? And if I do this again, they're going to be slightly different. Okay? And if I do it a third time, it'll be slightly different. Okay? This is a picture. This is the most irreproducible thing you can imagine. Okay? The gel isn't just set just right. It might just come out a different way. So we wish that we could look at the spot and say, oh, it's got this size and this pH. It's got to be this protein. Can't do that at all. So then what we'll do is we'll cut out one of these spots and use the next technique to figure out what protein might be in there. But literally, people look at these pictures and they say, well, here's a picture from cancer, here's not cancer, and oh, I see this spot here and I don't see it here. Maybe it's a protein of interest. Okay? And there's a whole informatics trying to figure out and automate and image process these things, but they're terrible. Okay? This is not reproducible. Look how these spots are streaky. Right? I mean, it's just it's a mess. Each spot has dozens, hundreds of proteins in there. Okay, here's one paper, okay, I picked. These guys looked at all of these spots and sequenced all of them, okay, just to identify all these different proteins. So they've numbered each one, okay? So back in 99, this is the Geigy group, actually, in this building, okay? I'm laughing at this, but I mean, it's a huge amount of work to do this. So from that one spot, we might want to figure out what proteins are there. And the technique that most people use is this technique called mass spectrometry. And so the way this works is you get this little spot, and there's a whole bunch of peptides in there. Even though we separated them a lot in these two axes, there's a bunch of proteins here. And if you actually shoot it into this detector, so what mass spectrometry does is it takes a spot and hits it with a laser, and the things come flying off of there, okay? And the way that they fly off of there depends a lot on the size of the protein and the charge of the protein. So basically, in the end, through all of this, you basically have one axis here, mass divided by charge. And I have peaks, basically, that are coming off of the detector. Oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff at this, now there's nothing, there's a whole bunch, there's nothing, like that. Mass versus charge. So the way this works is, what you can do is these proteins here, you can digest them, okay? Remember how these are long proteins, right? That same enzyme that I have in my pancreas that's still working on my lunch, I can use it to my advantage. I can take this spot and digest these peptides into sequentially shorter proteins. So here's one protein that's 40 amino acids long. Here's one with 39, here's one 38, here's one 37, here's one 36. And basically I do this in such a way so that all of these peptides get broken up into a series of smaller peptides. Okay, why am I doing all this? Okay, why am I doing all this? Because this is the trick. If I have one protein that's 30 amino acids long, and one same protein but it's only 29 amino acids long, the difference in size is the last amino acid, right? Then they go from 29 to 28. The difference in size there is that amino acid. So if I basically successfully cut this one amino acid at a time and have a whole range of these, then I've got the difference in sizes to help me tell what that last amino acid was. And that's how we use this. We just look at the difference in peaks. The difference between the peaks is what we measure here. No, not at all. It's a mess, right? The chart, it's a ratio, okay? So this, there's a bunch of peaks here, but that same peptide might be somewhere else too if it happened to get an extra charge. Absolutely. It's not perfect at all. It's not perfect at all. Whole new area here that's dying for new algorithms. You do it your best shot. You look at the peaks here. There's naive ways to do it, but they're not perfect at all. And of course, there's some proteins that love to have variable amounts of charge more than others. So there's going to be some things that are easier to detect than others.
But, I mean, the technique itself, there are known methods of how amino acids fragment. The species themselves that they take are dramatic species.
We know the size of each amino acid, each of the 20, 21 amino acids, so we can tell if there's a difference of peak here, right? But remember, there are multiple proteins, too.
There's not infallible, but there's characteristic.
Absolutely, that's why we're able to use it at all. Okay?
And there's libraries of that, which allows you to...
Exactly. In fact, we can predict, right? We can look at every protein in the database and predict what it would look like when applied with trypsin to cut it. What would the peaks look like? Okay, and you can actually make predictions, and you basically take your pattern and compare it to the computer pattern. This might be predicted, this is the actual, and the computer, there's the algorithm here basically says this is the protein. Now there's another important point here I want to bring up. This is not quantitative. Okay, this helps you identify a protein in a sample, but it's not quantitative. It doesn't tell you how much there is. There's all sorts of newer, fancier techniques to compare this to some other sample to try to get some kind of quantitative measurement. But the way this is commonly used, it's just identifying. It's not quantitative.
Just a quick point. So in the Science Times and the New York Times this week, there's an article you saw about a test, a diagnostic for cervical cancer using mass spec.
Absolutely.
And they don't know how. It's just a machine learning.
I think I have that picture.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's the one. Okay. So here's ovarian cancer. Same thing, right? So these guys use a particular chip to do this, but it's the chip is the smallest piece of it. It's basically still a mass spec that's on the end. Here is unaffected, cancer one, cancer two. Here are all the different bands, and they said to hell with identifying them. Here is the pattern, right? Oh wow, I see a band here, but no band here. This must be diagnostic, okay? I will easily answer back. I mean, we're in danger of overfitting the data here, okay? You have hundreds of thousands of peaks here. And only four samples, okay? How hard is it to find them that will answer your question? I tend to believe these things when they have something to do with the biology, okay? If we go ahead and identify and there's some causal mechanism, that's great. But others are going to be very happy with this, especially since we have no other test for ovarian cancer today. That's fine. Or cervical cancer. From cervical cancer, we do pap smears. Ovarian cancer, we have nothing. If there is something in the blood, it's better than nothing, is what they would answer back. Okay, so here's basically the peak differences here. So they say, here's this peak, we think that's an arginine, or that's basically how this works. Okay, you use the differences in peaks, these things are called peak lists. Quantitative, we're not gonna go there, but basically you can take one sample and another sample and grow the one sample in heavy water. Okay, instead of H2O, we'll use H3O. And that extra H, it's not extra, well, actually, it's deuterium, right. So it's not just deuterium, but you can also use other different isotopes. But basically, you have the same atom. Like carbon can have 12 protons, or you can have 12 plus a neutron. You can have all sorts of other things in the nucleus of the atom that could change how it looks on mass spec, because you're changing the mass just slightly. And then you could tell which sample it came from and then try to quantitate that way. But again, the charge could change, okay? So one protein is not in one spot. It's in a whole bunch of spots. You need to sum them all up. And they're overlapping.
If you're going to use trypsin and you're going to cut by one amino acid, then...
Okay, let me be clear. The trypsin cuts into manageable fragments. And there's another fragmenter in front of the machine that's actually cutting it up into these one amino acids. Go ahead.
You have only 21 different ways.
Yes.
That you can have. And you have maybe an integer number of charges.
Absolutely, that's right.
Probably you don't need to do anything more. You could pretty much form on what exactly was there.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, the only hard part is that a protein, you don't know where the protein is, okay? You see a whole bunch of spots there, and you see that it's here, but it could be on either side of the spectrum you're looking at. And if you let the machine run long enough, you get a huge amount of data off of that machine, okay? An unmanageable amount of peaks, okay? And we can look and isolate one peak, right? Here, from this peak, we go to this peak. From that peak, we go to this peak, okay? We've zoomed in so far to get the differences, but it could be elsewhere, depending on the charge. It's doable. People do get great results off of this, but by no means is the informatics done in this field yet, okay? And as more people use this technique, it's screaming for new algorithms.
Quick statement. Is it obvious to everybody that the concentration of protein is not the same as the concentration of RNA? Everybody should know that.
Right. Like I was saying, we're using it as a proxy, right? But let's be clear. If the cell has a whole bunch of this protein there, and it's happy with that amount, and it's not going anywhere, it doesn't need to make more. That's the simplest example of something where there might be zero RNA, but a whole lot of protein, right? If that protein is degrading really fast, then the cell might need to make more. But there's a massive disconnect here. Some things are going to be correlating, a lot of things are not, right? All these things about proteins, which we don't know, depends on the protein.
I just have a quick question. I'm just not sure. When you lose small molecules in CNS, you don't prepare the material in such a way that you eliminate the charges. Is there any equivalent way that you could prepare?
To eliminate the charges?
Yeah.
You're asking a detail, I don't know.
No, because that's the reason why when you lose small molecules, you can use M over Z as a proxy for max.
Absolutely, but the thing is that it's picking up charge, right?
Yeah, of course, it's charge ultimately, but the reason why is when you lose small molecules, you can use that as a proxy of mass.
Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure it's not done.
The biggest problem though is that these are longer than small molecules, right? I mean, these are much larger masses. That's the problem. And the proteins themselves, right? If you just chopped off the thing that's holding the charge or that loves the, if you just chopped off the polar part of it, it's going to have different properties. That next peak could be wildly different. It totally depends on that.
Before my microrelay lecture is, why is it if it, in fact, as a tool of the plane, protein function, protein synthesis, is not in a one-to-one relationship with RNA synthesis, we're actually so successful in defining disease classes and defining prognosis just based on RNA expression? Why should we also put a lot of bucks into proteomics? Or could we?
I think the next one is the last slide here. Now, despite it being hard to measure these things, there are definitely companies that are trying to make protein chips here, okay? One way to detect proteins is to have an antibody against a protein, right? That's how people have been doing things like Western blots for decades. And you can radio label them and stuff. So you can make a plate here where each well has an antibody against one particular protein, or you can make, for example, people make a cytokine array. So this array just basically, each spot looks for a different cytokine. You can buy these things, but you can't do this comprehensively like you can with microarrays. That's the point, okay? To look across all possible proteins, plus alternate splice products in proteins, just can't do it today. You can do functional assays as well. Here's the antibody array. That's it. So we talked about sequencing, polymorphisms. We skipped SAGE. Most people are using microarrays now. We didn't even cover wafers. Let's cover wafers in a second. 2D page, mass spec, protein arrays. Let me at least cover the wafer thing because it's worth knowing that. These are all slides. So the wafers blow my mind, and that's why I like to end with this. So those companies that make these microarrays, they don't just make them one at a time. They make them the same way computer chips are made. They're made 40 at a time in a wafer. And then they're just cut out. So there's a company called Perlogen, which is owned by that other company, Affymetrics, that basically said, why are we making 40 of the same array? Let's just make a wafer, one big array. And with that, you have so many spots. You have 60 million spots in one wafer. It's about 5 inches. Okay, I'm drawing it like this, but it's really this small. Okay, you can see the size here. This is the wafer. 5-inch square has 60 million probes. So they've even 2 years ago, they showed how you can use these wafers to resequence an entire chromosome. And that was one paper. You think about how many years it took to sequence the first chromosome in the Human Genome Project. They can just do that now over a weekend. Because they basically have each spot is a moving window of 25 base pairs. So what do I mean by that? They took the smallest chromosome, I think it was like 22, 23. They took the smallest chromosome and they took the first 25 nucleotides and they put it in one spot. And then the middle one, they said, well, it could be an A, T, C, or G, so that's 4 spots. Now let's move to the next one, to the next one. So they have a moving window of 25 nucleotides going from one end to the other end of the chromosome across a series of wafers. And once they have that done, they could just take anyone's blood and just basically get the entire pattern now. And they don't have to say, well, I think there's a SNP here or a SNP there. They just know all the SNPs now, right? Because it's just a matter of how many humans you put on the array, and it's just blood. The big issue, each scan, the TIFF image takes 10 terabytes, okay? We were just learning about gigabytes. Terabyte is 1,000 of those, and this is 10 of them for just one of these wafers, okay? So it's well known that life science data is growing much faster than this famous Moore's Law. Moore's Law is from Gordon Moore from Intel that said that microprocessor power doubles every 18 months. Life science data is growing way faster than that. This is just one example of this. They've publicly stated that they can sequence all SNPs in a human in 10 days. Not just the ones we know about, they just know all of them. And this is just one of many companies, there's many in the 95 Beltway here that are doing the same thing as competition. So remember how I was joking around that you could fit your entire genome on a CD-ROM? It is absolutely conceivable that we can have this within the next 1 or 2 years if we want it. Okay? The technology is there to do this. They certainly have the hard drive space there at Perligent to do it. So, all right, I think that's it. We should end since we're a little bit over.